and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, in honor of Alaska Day, former commercial fisherman and Alaska legislator Clem Tillian. He gave the 7th annual Alaska Day Polaris Lecture on our first 50 years, a mixed bag, more good than bad. Hosted by the 49th State Fellows from UAA and the Cook Inlet Historical Society, Clem was recorded speaking at the Anchorage Museum on Alaska Day, October 18, 2011.
So again, thank you all for attending this year's annual Alaska Day Polaris Lecture. My name is Samantha Emerson, and I am a member of the 49th State Fellows Program, as are all the people that you just saw standing up here on stage. We're a liberal arts-focused program based out of the Honors College at UAA. We put most of our focus into studying history, political science, and philosophy. And as well tonight, we are being hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society. And so I'd first of all just like to go ahead and introduce Professor Stephen Haycox. He's gonna come up and talk to you guys a bit more about Polaris Lectures.
Thank you, Samantha. 49th State Fellows Program is a program that Jim Muller and I started in the Honors College at UAA some years ago. The students that you saw here on the stage are students who have exceptional talent and have made a special commitment to learn about the origins of democracy and free government, and to take courses that are in the liberal arts that are suitable for the kind of life that an engaged and free citizen should engage in, and we are delighted to have them here. The Polaris Lecture Series is one of the activities that the 49th State Fellows Program supports. The Polaris Lecture Series is self-supporting. We try to bring from outside and from inside Alaska every year a series of speakers who can enlighten us and stimulate us, such as we will have this evening, certainly. I would like to introduce now the president of the Cook Inlet Historical Society, co-sponsor of tonight's lecture on Alaska Day, an annual lecture for the Polaris Lecture Series, Jim Barnett. Jim has been president of Cook Inlet Historical Society, now, as we like to say, since time immemorial, and has carried that society to greater heights than it had been in the past. It has become a very active member of the museum and sponsors a series of its own, a lecture series of its own, every third Thursday here at the museum. And the Cook Inlet Historical Society has graciously agreed to co-sponsor this Polaris lecture on a Tuesday night, Alaska Day coming on different days of the week at different years, and we are most grateful for that support. So please join me in welcoming Jim Barnett.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you, by the way, to you and your lovely wife, Dagmar, for a lovely evening this evening where we had an opportunity to visit with our speaker just before our presentation tonight. Before I introduce our speaker, I just want to give you a couple of commercial messages on behalf of Cook Inlet Historical Society. The first is that if you're interested in our program this year, here's the program. It's available out front, and it will describe to you our lecture series for the balance of the year. As you know, we meet here each month on, as Steve said, on the third Thursday. This year, we're celebrating the history of art in Alaska in anticipation of the museum's planned exhibition this upcoming summer on art history. And I'd encourage you all to come on back. We would enjoy your participation and membership, of course. I'd also like to mention that we've joined the modern age and we've created a new Kwikuna Historical Society website. So if this is too burdensome for you to take it, you'll actually find this on the cookinlethistory.org website. You'll find this as a PDF there as well. So that'll remind you of your upcoming lecture series. I think we all know Clem. It's kind of silly for me to attempt to introduce him, since probably all of you in the room know him as well or better than I do. There are a couple of paragraphs about Clem and his history in Alaska, and we're all thrilled to listen to him regale us on the first 50 years and some things maybe that we have to look forward to. One thing that's not in the program that I hope you touch on is when Clem first arrived in the Kenai Peninsula, he walked from Anchorage to Homer, and that was in 1947, so I think that'll be an interesting conversation as well. I'm thrilled to introduce Clem. He's come to us once before in a lecture, and I'm sure this will even be a better one. Thank you very much for coming, Clem. I give you Clem Tillian.
Yeah, he talks about walking to Homer the first time. Actually, I was heading for Seldovia, but I went out to the end of the spit and then took another 10 days along all those fjords till I got to Seldovia. The thing about walking cross country when you can't carry anything, I had a blanket, a piece of canvas, a 22 rifle, and some fishing gear, was that you spend half your time looking for something to eat. I can tell you more of the memories of what I didn't like to eat, like no matter what you do with it, boiled owl is not very good. Whoever said eat crow had tried it. A crow is made up of feathers, skin, sinew, and bones. There's nothing else. There's nothing you can eat. I was just looking around, a 21-year-old back from a government-paid vacation on the Solomon Islands, and had malaria pretty bad. My wife said I was the homeliest looking boy she'd ever seen. Looked like something out of Buchenwald. Every bone stuck out, and my skin was bright yellow from Adabrin. And you know, it's according to which end of the TV tube you're looking at. I looked at a 19-year-old girl, and there wasn't a brick out of place, you know. And after many years of marriage, there still wasn't. It's just, you know, I am in love. And though she's gone, I'm still in love. The talk tonight was, what I wanted to talk about was that first 50 years when we started. You know, the population when I got here was quite small, around 100,000 people. There'd been 300,000 natives in Alaska, but smallpox, syphilis, the flu epidemic, tuberculosis, there were 35,000 when I got here, and they were still the majority. It certainly made it easier for moving out into the new lands, much like the pilgrims that landed to find the plague had emptied New England. It wasn't a big fight with anybody. Today I work for the Aleut Corporation, representing them at fisheries meetings, and I enjoy it. I wasn't in favor of statehood when it first was talked about. I wanted Commonwealth. I was in the old Commonwealth Party. I wanted more closer to independence. But that wasn't the way it was going to break. People had ambitions, and it was going to become a state. And I still opposed it until they offered us management of our fish and game resources. Alaska's gone through a number of different phases. Oil had not become of any importance yet at this time. Salmon paid most of the taxes. The canned salmon industry pretty well ran things from Washington, D.C. The management was atrocious. They'd always offer 110% of what the living resource could take. And things were in what I'd considered fairly dire straits. And so we thought we could do better. I was doubtful when I looked at the Constitutional Convention and had a vote on who went there. whether they'd ever amount to anything or not. And so it was much with amazement that I looked at the document they turned out and found it was rather good. Part of this I would give credit to being fisheries oriented myself was to Senator Bill Egan, later chairman of the who came to the convention with a fellow by the name of Clarence Anderson, who'd been a professor of biology at the University of Washington, and he was territorial fish and game, and he brought him with him. So they put right into the Constitution things that many other states don't have that require a sustained yield, and that this they seem to understand better than it took me some years to understand that Alaska is the only land grant state in the nation. That I have a lot to thank to people like Wally Hickel and Bob Atwood, who I didn't always get along with, but he was there, that pushed for that extra 100 million acres that made us a land grant state. We had to vote on whether to accept statehood or not, and I was torn, but I did vote for it because of the Fish and Game Management, who I realized that we'd have nothing left if we left it under the federales much longer, and that the only thing that the new state was not allowed to manage would be the Fur Seal, which had a treaty at that time. Later I became a commissioner in the Fur Seal, and the Halibut Commission, and come to think of it, later on I became a commissioner on that one too. And we started out with a perfectly clean slate, somewhat confusing. And I remember Clarence and the fisheries, coming back to that, Clarence Anderson calling his management biologists in and said, gentlemen, there were no women in it at that time. There are now, thank God. The governor has said, bring the fish back to their former abundance, regardless of the pain inflicted on the people. We have this one chance to restore Alaska to something. And Clarence, addressing his area management biologist, said, now I'm charging each one of you to make sure that every spawning stream in your district has the maximum needed for a maximum escapement. If you allow a over-escapement, thus depriving fishermen of their livelihood, you can expect to be criticized. On the other hand, gentlemen, if you allow an under-escapement, you can expect to be fired. And we have eight times more salmon today than we did in 1959. It went right on through that. As oil was found, and I was a freshman young legislator down there, I realized we just had the Swanson River oil find. Our 90% at 1% severance tax brought us little or nothing. You know, if you were not one of the leasees that got it under the whole federal system, and several of them did, they did very well. Locke Jacobs gathered a group together here in Anchorage for the most part, and they all put some money up, and he went out and got the leases and hit oil. But for us, representatives of the state, it did nothing. And people have always often said to me, you're a Republican, you don't believe in taxes. And I said, wait a minute, I'm a representative of the people that own this resource, and I'm not giving it away. My father, who served time as a mercenary and later from this country, and my grandfather before him, always said, remember, when you take the king's shilling, you fight the king's war. And I was taking the people's money, $2,400 a year at that time for a legislator, and therefore it was my obligation to fight their war. And I didn't see where we were making anything out of oil. And it's funny how little party line meant in those days. The breakdown was on totally who was going to stay in Alaska and who wasn't, almost. You can count on it. Those that had children and had moved here and were going to stay here permanently were for making drastic increases to the cost of doing business here. The others wanted as many jobs as possible, and as much money as possible for their retirement in some foreign country like Britain or the United States. Mine has been very simple. I immigrated here with intention of Alaska being the place I would live the rest of my life and die here. We were very lucky in a number of ways. Bill Egan chose very wisely Phil Holdsworth as head of his Natural Resources Commission and Division of Lands, and he took Chuck Herbert, and they went out and picked the best of everything in that early selections. Now, Bill had to step aside for the native land claims before all the state selection had come, so the natives got to pick some ahead of our state. But on the other hand, I supported this because it was another 44 million acres that would be out of federal control. And I wanted as much of the land out of federal control as possible because I consider them a disastrous manager. We were very lucky in, as things progressed, things like the limited entry, which the governor supported, and we were able to get through, limited the number of fishermen in any one given thing, had to do a constitutional amendment for that, got it through. I was in the U.S. Congress gallery when the Magnuson Act passed. I'd been an advisor to President Nixon on oceans and atmosphere and was there looking at that. And to me, it was the only way we were going to save living resources anywhere. And we were very lucky at the time that it passed that we had Hammond as our governor, who'd been a representative of the International North Pacific Fisheries Commission and knew a little something about it. And when it did pass, we were in the governor's office in Juneau and called Governor Evans of Washington State and sat there talking it all over that who would bring the best management to Alaska's resource. And it was pretty well a pick of the professionals that had been at the top of all the struggles to try and save something under the old system. And so we looked at, I remember Hammond saying, could I make a suggestion on the appointments, Governor? And he said, well, it's according to who you did. And we picked Donald McKernan, the ambassador to fisheries for the United States, and Harold Lockin, that had been on the first Halibut Commission in 1932, as the suggestions from Washington. He said, you've got them. And then we went through and picked people like that. And I remember Stevens coming up to me and saying, you're stacking the deck. And I said, if I have the deck in my hand and I'm in command, I'd be misusing my gift if I didn't stack the deck. Yes, it's stacked. It's stacked in favor of the fish. In the years that I served in the legislature, I always made that plain to my people that don't put me between you and a fish because I'm going to vote with the fish. Actually it was more than that. I, by then, had children, assumed that they would have children, and now, my oldest great-granddaughter is 22, so it's been and lives here, that all management should be for the generations coming, not for the generation that's here today, because you can find some excuse while you need it right away. But if you look at it that way, another thing that I always put in fisheries management was the general public owns this resource. We're in a land-grant state, the commons that you heard Wally Hickel say so often. And as such, a quality product to the consuming public is at a reasonable cost should be the management goal that you aim for. The fisheries are not the exclusive property of the fishermen until caught and delivered. That it belongs to the people and they should return some return from it. I later on, when we got in position with Terry Gardner, a Democrat but also a fisherman, as Speaker of the House, we raise fish taxes 300%, so they'd cover their own costs. I wish the tourist industry would do that. It covers, what, $1 for every $7 the state spends? We were very lucky as the Magnuson Act passed that we were able to not only pick the top, we were successful in Stephen's work and using the six, the majority of one that we had. And we were very lucky having Elmer Rasmussen as our first chairman. And somebody said, well, why did you pick a banker for your first chairman? Because he financed about 60% of the boats being financed in Alaska through National Bank of Alaska and had gone to every fisheries meeting and served on almost everything so that he knew the biological facts of life. Because looking at the bottom line of what somebody caught last year does not help you in knowing what the future is. That you have to know whether the crab are going to go up or down, and the codfish are going to go up or down, the salmon are going to go up or down when you loan the money. And so as our first chairman, it was mostly foreign fisheries at that time, we set out to make sure that the door would be closed when we had enough fishermen and that we would never exceed the quotas set forward. We picked a very good scientific and statistical committee. And I must say, in all these many years, since 76, the North Pacific Management Council has never exceeded the amount given forward by their scientists, unlike New England and some of the rest that are constantly doing it. We have sometimes taken less for market reasons, like we didn't want to dump that much pollock on the market at once or something. But we have never exceeded what the scientists said we can do. And Alaska can be very proud of the fact that worldwide, there are three places in the world that are considered to have managed their fisheries well: New Zealand, Iceland, and Alaska. We are 62% of all the fisheries in the United States. As this was taking place, oil was blooming in Alaska. I was there when the land chosen by Phil Holdsworth was auctioned off and brought $900 million. And Gene Guess, who was Speaker of the House, and several of the others got a group together, and we hired advisors to tell us what to do with it. Earl Hillstrand was saying, lock it up in some fund. Don't spend it on an increased government, but leave something for the future. The feeding frenzy, I've seen that in the South Pacific when the sharks were there. It was a pretty pathetic demonstration of greed. And we pushed through a bill on the longevity bonus, which was mine, and we had a $100 million fund to fund it, permanent fund. Governor Miller vetoed this. Why he did the permanent fund, I don't know, but he did the whole thing because I wouldn't back the ice road to the Arctic. And by the next year, we were able to put the bill through, but the $100 million wasn't there anymore. We had pretty well scoffed up the whole $900 million. It's why later on when we did pass the investment program that we passed, and I was by then had risen up enough to be president of the Senate, and Jay Hammond said, get me that bill, no matter what you have to do. And then he corrected it and said, no machine guns. I looked at what we need. I said, I can get it. And I just, Senator Sumner and Senator Homan that were holding it, wanting low interest loans for the business community instead of a permanent fund, wouldn't come down from finance. So I had the state troopers go up and handcuff them and bring them to the floor of the Senate in handcuffs, discharged them, appointed myself. And we were sitting there, John Sackett and Ernie Haugen and I, and Sam Cotton, I'll tell a joke on that later, and Terry Gardner, some of these on the other side, and Hugh Malone saying, now, Clem, I want to explain how this works. And I said, for God's sake, Hugh, it's a quarter after 11. The governor's sitting upstairs. Could I just sign the damn thing? And so Hammond always said he doesn't know who invented the permanent fund, but he knows who the midwife was. And the only regret that I have on the permanent fund was that, unlike fisheries, where we could look at a failed federal system that admitted every mistake that man could invent, and therefore teaching us what not to do, that we were one of the early ones to get oil in a community property amount. And the fact that we only chose 25% was that's all we thought we could get through. We wanted as big a permanent fund as possible because we knew that it would just bloat government something terrible. And what you didn't want to do is when the oil is gone, be caught with something you couldn't afford. To go back to when we first got the $900 million, we hired an advisor by the name of Walter Levy that did a great deal of the work for Saudi Arabia. And he came to us and said, now remember when you pump your first barrel of oil, that oil will always be an enclave within your state. To consider it part of your everyday economy is to court disaster. 100 years from now, the only person that will see Prudhoe Bay will be an Eskimo looking for a caribou. That someday all the oil will be gone. It's just a matter of time. So unless you do something that leaves you better off when it's gone, then you have committed a cardinal error. And we thought we'd done rather well to get the 25% in the permanent fund. It's $40 billion today, and I'm rather proud of it. Until last year, this year when we were at the dialogue, and here was a group that had come back from Norway, and I'd already heard this, the Norwegians had the advantage with us that we had had with the federal government. We'd been the first one to form a permanent fund. They came over to look at how we'd done it, how we managed it. We manage it very well, incidentally. They went back to Norway and put 100% of all of the bonuses and royalties into their permanent fund. It is now $780 billion. Then they said the second mistake that we made was repealing taxes. The repeal of the income tax was a monumental disaster for Alaska. It left a whole section of our people paying nothing, and all these people that come up to work in our country going home without paying anything, and it leaves the citizenry with no responsibility to the government that they're supporting. The Norwegians were very careful not to repeal anything, saying we know we're going to in the future. But right now, their 4% that they take out of the fund every year just about equals the Norwegian national budget, which means that when they give out oil leases or deal with the oil company, they don't need them. They can live without them. They're going to make sure that they pay an adequate amount. They're not in a rush to do it. If we had done what the Norwegians did, if we'd been second like we were in the fisheries and could look at them when they made their mistakes, we'd now have $480 billion in our permanent fund, and at 4 or 5%, which is well within the earning capabilities of the fund, we would have 3/4 or more of Alaska's budget paid for without waiting for the next oil sale or the next barrel of oil to be pumped. This gives you a national freedom or a state freedom that you could have nowhere else. And if I was young and in the legislature, I'd be pushing really hard now to lock up every bit of bonuses and royalties, not taxes. Taxes are what you charge them for the cost of opening the roads, the cost of operating it, the cost of the educational impact they put on the state. That's a standard tax. People ask me how I felt on Pebble Mine. You're a fisherman. Are you going to oppose it? I said, no. Am I going to support it? No. At 1%, it still has the old taxes until the legislature gives me a decent return of 10 or 12% royalty plus taxes to cover all the roads and other infrastructure that's necessary. Then I will look at it. No guarantee I'll support it. Then I will look at it. then I will see what we can do for the environmental safeguards that pit its against another resource to make sure that you don't wipe out one to get another, one that has a longer future than that. But on the other hand, would I lock up $400 or $500 billion worth of my grandchildren and great-grandchildren's future? No. I would vote to keep it on the table, but until they show me some tax revenue from it, it's all a case of how much I will sell my grandchildren's future for. And believe me, it's pretty high. All I can say is we have done more good than bad coming in this last 50 years. There's nothing that I can be ashamed of my state for. Would I do it different? What one of us with 20/20 hindsight wouldn't have done something different? There's all sorts of things that you'd like to take a little look at that's different. But on the whole, the bulk of the legislators that went to Juneau from the very first one went there to do good. A few of them, like one I can tell you that said, I never passed a bill that didn't make me money. A lawyer from Fairbanks that was very powerful in the early state legislature. But the most of them went there to be well thought of. Some of them don't understand that being popular and well thought of are two separate things. I became Wally Hickel's fish czar, and he came to me actually and said, would you take over the fisheries? And I said, well, under what circumstances? And we'd gotten along like a lit match and an open can of gas in the last time. And he said, well, I've got two things I want. I want fresh fish year round on the Alaskan table. And it's unconscionable to leave the people of the Bering Sea standing on the beach while somebody else takes all the fish and they get nothing. Get them involved. And I said, can you do it? And I said, yeah. Can you take the heat? You know, what I'm going to do is very unpopular with a huge fleet out of Seattle and a lot of very selfish people scattered all over the world. Will he back me? We got the black cod, halibut, instead of a two-day season as we had before. It's 180 days plus various districts, so you got a steady supply of fresh fish coming in. The fishermen, instead of getting about 80 cents a pound, are getting $6 or $7 a pound because it goes on the fresh market. The public's getting a better quality fish, getting it all year. Before that, they were paying more for the cold storage charges and the interest on the debt than they were for the fish. And then the other was the community development quotas. Now you hear all about the corruption, the people that are taking $750,000 to manage a operation on there, but all I can say is you took a people that had nothing, and believe me, the Bering Sea, it was pretty bleak. And last year we brought in $178 million to those villages. Do we have more to do? Yes. But basically, all I can say is I once said to Wally, he says, I'm sorry that, you know, the heat that you're taking. And I said, Wally, the only thing that I regret is that I can't pay you for the privilege of doing the job. I loved it. I loved having a man that backed me when I did it, because there's nothing that will destroy any manager other than having his boss have second feelings and can you modify this or can you change that? You either turn it over to somebody. I've been a captain since I was 28 years old, and I can only say that the sea teaches you one thing. God so loved the world that he didn't send a committee to run ships. And we've been quite successful. We could do a great deal more. I've been to both Palin and Parnell to ask that they form a Department of Energy and get Alaska off carbon. Now, I'm not one of those that feels that if you did all the things that Al Gore told you with, the polar bear would come back and the Arctic Ocean would freeze shut again. The Arctic Ocean was open in the year 600, or till the year 600. At the time of Christ, which I consider the year you should count, after all, we date everything from the year one. Let's go back to what the climate was the year one, and let's say that's the normal climate. The Arctic Ocean was open. There were villages of up to 1,600 people on some of those islands in west of Baffin Island that have been frozen for the last 1,500 years. This is a perfectly normal climate change. Carbon's bad. Those are two subjects. It would make good economics to form a Department of Energy and invest in those things that people in small areas cannot invest in. To have taken the Terra Lake hydroelectric project in Kodiak and doubled its size, which was only a 6-foot rise in the dam, we'd have been able to put the whole city on electric heat and burn no diesel. Whether they'll find anything, I hear it's been bad news at Mount Spur. They hit a cold spot. Drilling geothermal is just as risky as drilling oil. You go down there, and if it doesn't steadily increase in heat, you've got a dead hole. If you go down 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 feet, and then you come to a spot that's colder, you've just lost everything you invested. So you cannot expect the Chugach Electric or some outfit like that to front that kind of cost. And I feel that is where my state should be looking. We can do a great deal. There's a lot of areas that are going to change drastically. You need somebody that's fairly cold-blooded, because there's some areas you can't do anything about. The ice cap at Shismarif, that's, as global warming comes, that's going to melt. Barrow, that's going to be totally remodeled, but it's not any different than the Yakutat or Yakutaga coast. The storms will roll in all the way from Spitsbergen. Do we have a lot to do about transportation? Yes. They'll be going through the Northwest Passage on a regular basis within 3 to 5 years. It's already open on the northeast. The trouble is with the Russian side, it's shallow. It's much deeper going through the Atlantic, or the eastern side. Do I expect this to happen? Yes. And what I can say is, don't put your head in the sand. You change those things you can change and modify or cooperate with those things that are unchangeable. That's with every major change, be it climate or otherwise, there are great opportunities. In 1947, I saw a decadal oscillation that wiped the codfish out of the Gulf of Alaska. I was packing codfish till 1950, and then suddenly there wasn't any. And I switched to king crab, was one of the first five. We were using old bed frames from the military base up here that they were selling them surplus after World War II, covering with chicken wire and bringing in tons of king crab that at that time I was getting 8 cents a pound for, because Dungeness was worth more, people were used to eating it. There are opportunities with everything we do, and if we don't take a chance of them, we're crazy. Alaska is going to change drastically. It needn't all be bad, a lot of it can be good. Really what my talk was about, and Dr. Haycock said I should end early enough that there was time for questions. Do I have disappointments? Yes, the Zobel case is one that just makes me cry. The pioneers' homes were, the Marine Corps barracks was bought by the first territorial legislature in 1913 to provide a pioneers' home for the old miners, and it required 15 years residency, because the danger of anything that didn't have residency was that people would bring their older Aunt Emma or whatever up and warehouse her at your expense, and you cannot do that. A little state cannot afford it. And so the Zobel thing, it damaged our pioneers' homes. It killed the longevity bonus that I wrote, and has done us great damage. Now, rather than cry about it, let's figure what we can do here and how we can go on. you know, I'm just looking at this. I can look at the fisheries, I have no regrets. I can look at the oil and I have the regrets of not putting everything in to where we can build it, and where do we go now? Lewis Lapham wrote it in, when he looked for Harper's, wrote that article on the time of the first 900 million. And Lou Dishner, who later went to jail for other things, said, well, you've come down to piss it up against a wall. And Chuck Cicero say, oh, no, roads, schools. He said, that's what I said. If you build something that you cannot afford to maintain, you've committed one of the greatest acts of stupidity that mankind can get. It's like paying a down payment on a car that you can't meet the next payment on. And so I'd rather at this time, you wanted me to keep it to about 20 minutes? It looks like that's about what I've held it to. Are there questions from this group?
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Clem Tillion, former commercial fisherman and Alaska legislator. Hosted by the 49th State Fellows from UAA and the Cook Inlet Historical Society, Clem gave the 7th Annual Alaska Day Polaris Lecture at the Anchorage Museum on October 18th. Following his talk entitled Our First 50 Years, A Mixed Bag, More Good Than Bad, Clem responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, is there a book about your life that we can buy?
No, I decided I had a fire in 1980, lost my home, my library, and my granddaughter. And nothing that really prepares you to dig through the ashes for looking for a little Alice. And I figured at that time that there went all the journals. I just let it go. I don't think that my life is important. I hope that a few of the things I did will be. Was it exciting? Yes, I was 17 when I landed in Guadalcanal. I came out of the military, one rate below that which I had enlisted at. I learned the local language and I disappeared into the jungles, and people said they're cannibals, and I said, yeah, but they're not eating me. They don't ever bother a trader. You know, I had a souvenir shop on Tulagi. Michener has me a little bit into the tales of the South Pacific. Had a grand time. I carry my discharge card with me because it has minor stamped across it. I'd finished my military career before I was able to buy a bottle of beer in the state of California. And came up here. Some doctor said, you're a mess, kid. Go to Alaska till you get rid of it. Well, I don't know whether I ever got it, but I met a little girl and the anchor went down. And the courtship and by itself was kind of interesting. I think they had that on a Valentine's thing here at one time. I went to ask, it was an older woman. I'd never had the nerve to get a woman. I was too shy around girls. I'd killed a man before I'd kissed a girl, you know. And my wife said that she thought something was wrong with her because I wouldn't look at her while we were eating dinner. Heck, I couldn't look at her and swallow, too. You know? And finally, Ada Latham said, ask her out. And I said, she wouldn't go with me. Ask her out, you idiot. So I asked her out and proposed to her. My intentions are honorable, but I want a wife and at least 3 children. She said, well, for openers, what's your first name? You know? I was Red Tillion, don't say. So I went and asked her parents for permission to court their daughter, and she was on the next steamer out. And I found out that the mail from Homer didn't get to her, but the mail from Seldovia did. She slipped, as she left on the boat, she slipped me a little piece of paper with her grandmother's address on it. So I wrote to her every day, but could only mail it every few weeks, you know. In those days, things didn't run. Once a month was mailed. And she had a brother-in-law in the airport, the Air Force, that got her a ride back to Fort Rich, Elmendorf Air Force Base. And so in November 5th, 1952, I met the plane at the airport. That's all it was the military airport then. And took this little girl to a preacher at the Methodist Church. That was the only preacher I found that would just do it then. And the next time they saw their darling daughter, she was Mrs. Tillian, and I hope pregnant. As I said, that took a year, but not from lack of trying. But years later, I asked her mother. She said, I was wrong, you do make a pair. And I said, Margaret, you were born on a covered wagon coming out of Buffalo, Kansas, while it was heading west. You married a Danish sailor and went off to a homestead in Haines in 1916. Why would you not trust your daughter in her choices? Well, she said, I didn't want her to go through what I went through. And I said, did you ever regret it? She said, no, I was in love. And so that's what you have to remember when your kids' time comes. They have to take some god-awful chances. And I wasn't considered a goodbye. Elmer Rasmussen considered me enough to loan me the money to buy the island I now have. Even that was with a letter from Squeaky Anderson, who'd been the beach master at Iwo Jima, been the old graduate Kvarna Swedish Naval Institute, captain of the trading ship Tsar in the Aleutian Islands. And later on, when I'd paid it all off, Elmer never smiled at me. He just said, well, you've paid it all off in the required time. Here, you should keep this letter for your files. And it was the letter from Squeaky and saying, Elmer, he's a crazy kid, but he does catch fish. So, here I'm spending too much time talking. Yeah. Yes?
Next, another audience member asked Clem, do you think the income tax would have been repealed if legislator Dick Randolph did not push for it? And do you think there is a chance it will ever come back?
The answer is I don't know about Randolph. I just don't know how it would have come out, whether he'd have raised the signatures. The Chamber of Commerce was against it. It's according to how hard we fought it. It was a risk. I'd rather take that risk than do it myself, thank you. And would my Republican friends, John Butrovich, called everybody in the state legislature and pleaded with them to not repeal the income tax. He said the year that we passed it, everybody, both Democrat and Republican, lost the election. That you literally will wipe out the legislature when we reintroduce it. And it's pretty hard to ask some politicians to commit political suicide. I never had any problem with that because I was always surprised when I kept getting reelected. I don't think it's the Republicans that will stop it. Will the people themselves allow it? The thing is that, remember, legislature is really a true cross current of the population that you live among. And sometimes you don't realize how shoddy your neighbors are till you see the people they elect. You know, it's, will the people let us do it? There was another hand up back. Yes.
Can you comment on the cultural changes Alaska would face if it were to adopt the Norway model of the permanent fund dividend?
The cultural shouldn't be too bad. Remember, the white residents of Alaska in 1940 were 70% from Northern Europe. The Americans didn't occupy Alaska till they could drive a car, and really till after they hit oil. Norway is close enough to us culturally that while their willingness to accept taxes might be more than we're willing to, and I think in many cases their tax load has become oppressive, some of their best brains are leaving Norway because it's too much. I think that properly explained and properly pushed by a group, that the Alaskan general public would realize what they've got versus what we have and support a good deal more. When we formed the Kenai Peninsula Borough to keep from putting all the weight on the property owner, we had the ranchers, for instance, at the head of the bay and Ketchumak Bay that would have been wiped out by a property tax that took everything like you have here in Anchorage. So we were able to sell a sales tax that was 50% for dedicated totally to schools, but that's the bulk cost anyway, so you can do that without cheating. I think the people are wiser than their elected officials in many cases, and yes, I think if properly presented, you could do it. Yes, Malcolm.
You were close with Governors Wally Hickel and Jay Hammond. Did you have anything to do with them eventually becoming friends?
Oh, what I could. What had more to do with it was the fact that there's a woman sitting right down there that I give much of the credit to, Ermalee. When you came that second term, Wally had had a number more grandchildren. And the Wally Hickel I saw in the second term was, what do my grandchildren get out of this? And that was totally different than the Wally Hickel of development in the as the young Wally Hickel. And so Hammond said, I'm totally amazed. This isn't the Wally I knew. This is the Wally anyone would love. You know? And so the thing was, yes, they did get together at the end. And it's a shame that they didn't have time to work together closely when they were on the same side. But all I ask of a politician is, does he have children? Is he going to stay here? Where's he going to be buried? Do you want your children to have more than you have, or at least as much? And if so, that's the ones I can vote for. And that was the Wally Hickel I knew in his second term. It was great. And the other thing that Hammond gave me that too was when he said, would you do this job? And it was a little awkward, as Kent Dawson said, his trying to keep something from the legislature when the president of the Senate was had a room at the mansion and was playing pool with the governor every evening. It was a little hard. That's, you know, they were more alike at the end. And I think that has to do with whether you feel that you immigrated here or you've just come for a living for a few years and will retire elsewhere. And I don't think Alaska will be mature until the day comes that the majority of those serving in the state legislature were born here. Then we'll have grown up. I looked at the history of California, and it wasn't, they totally changed when the majority of those serving in the legislature, remember when I was a kid, the bulk of the people in the California legislature had been from other states. Immigration was from other states was the majority of it. California is interesting. It was the only area that never became a territory because General Vallejo of the Mexican Army, who didn't like Santa Anna, said he'd stand the Mexican Army down and let the Americans occupy if they'd honor all deeds and bring California in as a state instead of a territory. And so Vallejo is the reason that there was never any big fight in California in the Mexican War. The Mexican soldiers just stood by as the Americans marched in, and America kept its half of it, honored all the Spanish deeds, and made California a state right to begin with. So all I'm saying is we'll probably grow up the day that we've produced all the people that we need for our own legislature to run our own affair.
Last, an audience member asked Clem, do you think ACES has been beneficial to the state as a whole?
I don't know enough to really make a deal on that. You know, it's come. Yeah, right now it's a wash. Yeah. I don't think it's done any damage, but, you know. I don't think anything that educates is going to give us an advantage. Going to the dialogue was interesting, but the thing I got out of the dialogue was only the people that went to Norway that had that to tell us. You know, if you can see how others do it and see it can be how badly they do it, that works too, because that's what saved our fisheries was federal mismanagement. Maybe what would help our future would be Norway's good management. They were also smart enough to not join the you know, they don't have euros, they have kroner. So they're not caught when one segment goes down. I just saw the 2 years closure at ADAC where I work for the Aleuts because the Portuguese went under and couldn't pay their bills. You know, and they were buying the codfish and they had it over there and we didn't get paid. So I think anything that shows the other people the mistakes as well as the good things will be beneficial. Gee, that's easy. Yeah. Well, it looks like when were they supposed to close this up, Dr. Haycox? Thank you. You know, could I add one more thing? I watched them stand up here and sing Alaska's flag song, and I remember Neva Egan playing the piano in the mansion and singing that song. And that's always what I think about when I hear it.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Clem Tillian, former commercial fisherman and Alaska legislator. Clem responded to questions from the audience following his talk entitled, Our First 50 Years, A Mixed Bag, More Good Than Bad, hosted by the 49th State Fellows from UAA and the Cook Inlet Historical Society. Clem gave the 7th Annual Alaska Day Polaris Lecture at the Anchorage Museum on Alaska Day, October 18, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.
The brilliant stars in the northern sky, the men, the timber.